We'll call a meeting of the Agriculture and Rural Development Policy Finance Committee to order on this Thursday morning. And we have one bill on the agenda, informational only today, by the way. House File 1634 pertaining to food law enforcement, provided the technical and conforming changes made, obsolete provisions repealed, and penalties imposed. This is a department bill, and we would call the department people to come forward to the witness table and give us their testimony on House File 1634. Good morning, and state your names for the record, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Woman. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and just for those of you who don't know me as well, I grew up in southern Minnesota, southwestern Minnesota in Renville County, and happy to be at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Prior to this, I worked for Congressman Walls in southern Minnesota. Commissioner Fredrickson asked me to join the department in January and gave me regulatory oversight of the Dairy and Food Inspection Division, the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division, and the Laboratory Division. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come before this committee, Mr. Chairman, as you review this food safety legislation. As you know, Minnesota has long prided itself on having the safest and most affordable, abundant food supply in the world. Our agricultural industry is a cornerstone of our state's economy, generating $13.3 billion in farm income and more than $4.3 billion in agricultural exports annually. Agriculture's total economic impact is many-fold more and generates an estimated 365,000 jobs across the state. Protecting the integrity of our food supply is a cornerstone mission of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Minnesota's citizens and farmers trust us to carry out this mission effectively and fairly. We honor that trust by taking food safety responsibilities very seriously. Our regulatory work is based on quality science and is reinforced by close partnerships with the Minnesota Department of Health, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Food and Drug Administration, and local partners around the state. We are proud to note that our food safety work, along with that of our partners at the Minnesota Department of Health, has been praised nationally as a sound model for other states. Our scientists were the first in the country to determine the peanut butter from Georgia was behind a nationwide outbreak of salmonella in 2008 and 2009. Our scientists were among the first in the country to determine that jalapeno peppers and not tomatoes were behind a multi-state outbreak of salmonella poisoning in 2008. Just recently, the Center for Science and the Public Interest released a report grading the performance of all 50 states on food safety legislation or food safety protection. Not only was Minnesota among the seven that earned an A, we were one of two states used as the gold standard by which other states were judged. Minnesota doesn't have this outstanding food safety record by accident. We earned it because our agencies employ some of the world's finest food safety experts and public health scientists, and I believe this committee and the legislature in the past have appropriated the necessary resources to be able to do that. Mr. Chairman, today we are here to discuss House File 1634, the Food Safety Bill. This bill is a result of several years worth of work and collaboration and partnership with our industry partners to develop a more modern, streamlined, efficient, and responsive food safety system in this state. I want to especially thank Darren McBeth and the Agri-Growth Council for their participation and work on this bill. Over the years, the Minnesota food safety statutes have evolved in a fragmented way, resulting in a handful of different chapters of law. For example, we have Chapter 29 or 28 that deals with cold storage. We have Chapter 28A The food handlers piece, the chapter 29 that deals with eggs, chapter 30 with wild rice, potatoes, and apples, chapter 31 dealing with food, chapter 31A dealing with meat, poultry, and chapter 34 with non-alcoholic beverages. As a result, each of these chapters have taken on slightly different definitions for common food safety terms, like the meaning for adulteration, misbranding, foods, or labeling. Mr. Chairman, this bill consolidates the food safety authority of the department from these several chapters into one, a new chapter 34A. It does not include feed. And I noticed one of the handouts included some reference to the food versus feed, or food and feed, and some of the objections of the industry, and we recognize those. We've had a long conversation with all the stakeholders, and at the end of the day, we agreed to take out feed, set it aside, and have some additional conversations this summer. I will note that there are some inaccuracies in that document, including whether or not we have civil penalties in other states, and some of our staff have put together a good survey of other states and have found that there are a number, about 14 other states that do have civil penalty authority. So we'll have those conversations, share that information, and look at that over the summer. This bill also eliminates the multiple definitions of the same word and creates one definition that applies throughout the chapters. It adds civil penalty authority. Currently, the department has two enforcement avenues. We have the administrative law judge route that costs the department and taxpayers of this state between $5,000 and $10,000 per case. And with all due respect, we have MDA, like other agencies, is being asked to do more with less. We have historically operated in a very lean and efficient way. But as we're being asked to look at these cases, the administrative case costs $5,000 to $10,000. The other route that we have is the criminal route. And as an assistant commissioner, and as these cases cross my desk, it's a difficult decision to make about whether to spend $5,000 to $10,000 of the state's resources, or whether to take a business person and make a criminal out of them. And so that's one of the reasons why we have asked for civil penalty authority. We believe that provides the department with the ability to work with the business owner to get them back into compliance, to help them through that process. And there's also, you know, the appeals process that would work with that. And I'll let our legal counsel take care of that. At this point, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop and ask Doug Spanier, our chief legal counsel at the department, to provide the committee with a quick section-by-section overview of this bill.
Good morning. Please identify yourself.
Good morning, Chair, committee members. My name is Doug Spanier. I'm an attorney at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'll go through the bill here. Again, as Matt suggested here, we're taking five or six chapters and consolidating it into one in the enforcement area. So these first couple sections here that I talk about are really some conforming amendments to take, and we're dealing with some of the definitions too. There were some multiple definitions throughout the different chapters. For instance, like for adulteration or misbranding, there were three at least in the feed area, the meat area, the food area. We're kind of combining that into one definition of adulteration and not changing that. We're not changing the definition. We're just putting it in one spot so everybody can go to one area to look at it. So in section one here, what we did was, again, it's sort of consolidating and taking out the existing in chapter 17 where we talked about criminal penalties for several chapters. We're taking that out because we're going to be referring to criminal penalties in chapter 34A. So we're taking out of here. So the only thing existing in chapter 17 for criminal penalties would be the feed chapter and 31B, which is the Packers and Stockyard Act. So they would remain the same. Again, feed is out of the bill. Section 2, Again, it's the same sort of deal. This is Chapter 17, talking about administrative penalties. The first part of there is moving the administrative penalty route existing, moving that and referring that to all those chapters over to 34A, with the exception of feed and the Packers and Stockyard Act. There is, in Subdivision 3 of Section 2, some new language dealing with the administrative Office of Administrative Hearing, that the judge and an ALJ would be able to equitably allocate the costs of an administrative hearing. Currently, right now, the department has to pay for it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, let me just jump in here on this one.
Mr. Wallman, go ahead.
On this situation, if you could envision, if we had a $150 fine and someone appealed or decided not that they were not going to pay the fine, we could take the fine to the administrative law judge. But as I said before, it costs the department a significant amount of money to go that route. And so at that point, at that juncture, we have the decision of whether or not to enforce the law or to spend the state's money on something that might be a frivolous kind of suit. And so the reason for this language being added into the bill is that if it is, and if the judge agrees that it is kind of a frivolous situation that we're dealing with, he can equitably distribute the costs of that.
Does equitably mean equally?
I think, Mr. Chairman, I think equitably would mean however the judge sees, you know, however the judge sees that the case should be handled.
Okay. Mr. Spanier, go ahead.
Committee members, going on to Section 3, actually Sections 3 through 6, they're referring to the definitions of labeling, misbranding, and adulteration that are in Chapter 25. It's just sort of a change of address location in terms of saying they're now going to be located in Chapter 34A. That's Sections 3 through 6. Section 7 is some new language we want to add. It details background check crimes, and we'll talk about that again in Section 11 here, what types of crimes would be looked at dealing with door-to-door salesmen. Again, I'll talk more about that in Section 11. But in Section 8, 9, and 10, same type of deal. We're moving the definition of person, food, and sale from Chapter 28A and just referring to it again into 34A. We're not changing the definitions at all. We're just making it in one location in 34A because there's so many multiple definitions around. That brings us to Section 11 that deals with it deals with mobile retail food handler's license. Those are the door-to-door salesmen. This allows for procedure to have us petition the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to do a background check on those people who want a door-to-door salesman license, and to do that check and get back to us. And the procedures are that if indeed any of these people were convicted of these crimes that are located in Section 7, that we would not be able to give them a license. And then there's some procedures in place for the applicant to appeal that process. This is the same process that is in place. It's the Kerry Koskinen rule. It's the same language that was in for the background checks that apartment managers have to have done to them. And it's just it's the same language. We talked to BCA about it, and we've had this on request from sheriffs, etc.
Mr. Chairman, there have been a couple of cases over the past few years where we have, you know, in one instance, we had a dementia patient that was living in her home, and a door-to-door salesman came back every day and sold her a box of meat. And eventually the relatives discovered this and found a whole room full of meat in her home. And so This is the kinds of situations that we're trying to address here.
Just out of an example, like a lot of Schwann's drivers, for example, would Schwann's get a blanket check, or would each individual driver have to have its own
Mr. Chair, check? Committee members, Schwann's would not have this because they're employees. Those people are employees of Schwann's.
Okay.
So these are, and so they're not, they wouldn't have these background checks. These are the people who are strictly the door-to-door salesmen in terms of they're not employees of anybody, they're independent contractors, et cetera. Schwann's, those people are employees of Schwann's, so Schwann's has the license, and we go that route. These are the strictly independent contractors that, have meat in the back of their truck, and they're trying to sell it door-to-door. This came to us from local sheriffs who have, as we understand it, these door-to-door salesmen use this as an avenue to case the houses. We've had one case where the guy knocked on the door, the lady didn't come to the door because she knew it was a door-to-door salesman. He didn't have anybody answer the door, so he tried to break in. And so we've talked to the Sheriff's Association about this. We've talked to BCA. I believe it was the Anoka County Sheriff was the one who really wanted us to put something in here on this and try to stop some of these cases that go on.
So could somebody, like a little old lady, ask to see somebody's license before they would trust them and let them in their home to sell food then, for example? How would this protect people?
Well, Mr. Chair, committee members, we wouldn't issue them a license if they've had these background check crime, if they've the listed crimes that are on here, so they wouldn't be able to have a license to do what they want to do. It would only, we'd only be issuing licenses to those who don't have this as a background and have a history of these crimes.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Greta Gothier from the Department of Agriculture. Anybody can ask to see a door-to-door salesman's license when they come to your door.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we would probably recommend that they should.
Yeah. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Spanier.
Sure. Our next section is Section 14. Sections 14 through 18 are, again, similar. These are just moving the definitions from 31, or of definitions of person, food, cell, labeling, from 31 over to 34A, so it's a change of address, just a location at 34A. Section 19, this was an old definition of pesticide. They don't use this definition anymore, so we're just, it's updating it to the current definition that's in 18B, what the definition of pesticide is. Sections 20 through 25, the same thing. We're just moving the definitions, just referencing that the definitions for adulteration, misbranding, label, and labeling from chapters 31 and 31A are being moved over to the new 34A. Again, these definitions don't change at all. We're just moving them over to one location rather than having them in multiple areas. Section 26, this is just a technical change to refer to 34. The old 31A.24 is being moved over to 34A.11, so it's just a technical change there. Sections 27 and 28, these were old definitions, actually the definition of adulteration and misbranding in Chapter 32 referenced a law that had been repealed years ago. So we're just currently, again, referencing it so that they actually reference a current definition. So, and then Section 29, this is the beginning of the new Chapter 34A. So this is the Section 29 lists all the definitions that we've been moving around. So now they're all in one location. Again, there's no change in the definitions. But we're just locating them there. That's Section 29, actually, through 32. The same definition, just moved to one spot. Section 33, this gets into the enforcement area. This moves all the enforcement from, the chapters into 34A. And it does add... this doesn't change the existing language for the most part. The only thing that it changes for enforcement And the section is the words copy and copy relevant papers. That's been added.
And Mr. Chairman, just for...
Mr. Wollman.
Just for clarification on this, it is consistent and conforms with, in terms of copy relevant papers and records, it conforms with the Federal Food Safety Modernization Act that has been passed, and so the industry is comfortable with that.
Mr. Spanier?
Sure. It gets, then we get to Section 34. Section 34 makes it a violation for knowingly making a false statement or record. This is some of what we did was, if you remember some years ago, we took the pesticide and fertilizer enforcement and made it into one chapter. We did the same thing with the nursery, plant pest, and seed. We made one chapter for all enforcement, and we're doing that with this dairy and food now. Some of the enforcement capabilities we had in these other chapters, we're also moving into here so that we have some uniformity in throughout the agency and what we can do for enforcement. This is one of them. This is located in another, the same language is located in another enforcement area in our agency. We're just moving it over here as well. Section 35, this language came, this is new language. It's as a recommendation from the Attorney General's office. It would make it a violation to sell in Minnesota or into Minnesota food from a place located outside the state of Minnesota that had not been licensed or inspected or otherwise approved by the Food Safety Authority in that state. Apparently, we don't have any language in there that makes it a, violation. So the AG's office suggested we put something in. Section 36, this outlines the procedures that we can take in an administrative action. Subdivision 1 there is the exact same existing law. We just moved over from an old chapter. Section 1B and C, this is language that is similar, again, in our pesticide and fertilizer area. We're just moving it over to here in terms of if they submit a plan review to us and we certify it, we can withdraw that plan if we find out that afterwards that there's a hazard to human life or the approval, what we got, wasn't what they actually built. Sometimes what we get as a plan is different from what actually gets built, and we can withdraw that. Subdivision 2, this is allowing us to revoke a license if a person has violated the law within the last 3 years. This is similar language to what we have in our pesticide and fertilizer area, and it will allow us to deal with some of these chronic offenders that we keep getting. Subdivision 2B is the same. We'd be able to do this for people who have had a license in this state, but they've had it suspended in another state for an offense reasonably related to those requirements. Again, this is similar language to what we have in our pesticide and fertilizer area, and this would be allow us to deal with those people who do state shopping. They might get suspended in another state, then they try to move to another state, and they keep trying to move. So we'd be able to deny them a license or revoke a license if they're trying to do that. Subdivision 2C, that's, again, similar language to what we have in our pesticide and fertilizer area. It would allow us to revoke a license if the individual has used a fraudulent means to evade or attempt to evade this chapter. So if they're trying to get away with something, we can deny their license. And then subdivision 2D is the process in which the due process, if we try to suspend or revoke a license, again, that hasn't changed. It's similar to existing law. We just moved it here. Section 37, this outlines the criteria that we use in determining an administrative penalty. It's the same factors as we have in current law, similar to what we have in other divisions and which the Department of Health uses. That's in Subdivision 1 there. Subdivision 1B outlines what information we need to put in the administrative citation. It's similar to existing law and also some compromise language with the industry in there. Subdivision 1C is similar language, again, to what we have in our pesticide and fertilizer division. Allow us to assess a penalty if the person subject to the order doesn't comply with the order in the time that we give them. And the subdivision 2 in that area is similar to language we have in our pesticide and fertilizer area. It outlines a process in which the department can collect the penalty once it has become a final order, and then it allows us to collect attorney's fees and doubles the penalty if the penalty, if the payment hasn't been given to us. Section 38 outlines the procedures for appealing an administrative penalty. The procedure is very similar to existing law with the following changes. We have we put in there language dealing with the ALJ. Normally there's way two routes. The ALJ can make recommendations to, when they hear a case, they make recommendations, and then the case comes back to the commissioner's office to make a decision. We had in the language that the ALJ makes the final decision, and there was some question. The Attorney General's office didn't like that language. They want to put it back to the general Chapter 14 language that says that the ALJ can make a recommendation and have it come back to the department. That's new language in there. And it also allows us to, again, from earlier language, allows the ALJ to allocate costs of the hearing equitably among the parties.
Mr. Spanier, are there ALJs around the state, or would they have to come down here for a hearing?
Mr. Chair, the ALJs are located at the Office of Administrative Hearing, which is located in the Department of Revenue building. The cases that get heard, however, depending on where the case is, the parties involved, the cases could be heard throughout the state and anywhere, depending. It's up to the ALJ, I think.
We have a question from Representative Anderson Bruce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Spanier, you mentioned in collection of penalties a civil action for double the assessed penalty plus attorney fees and costs. Is that a precedent, or is the state government always have the wherewithal to put into law the ability to collect attorney fees and costs for a civil action like this?
Mr. Spanier.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this was language, again, came existing from our pesticide and fertilizer area that's been in the law for, several years. And I believe it might even be in our nursery area. I'm not sure, what other agencies have this as well. But again, this is after a final order has been determined by a judge, and the judge has issued the penalty, and now we're at all the appealing process is done and taken place. So now it's just at a point where we're saying, okay, you need to pay after all the procedures have taken place. You need to pay that, and if they don't pay it in time, but I'm not aware what other agencies.
Follow up, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Spanier, are you strictly the lawyer for food law enforcement within the Department of Agriculture, or do you have other previews that you take care of?
Mr. Spanier.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm the attorney for the department, so I deal with pesticide and fruit in other areas.
Other areas, too. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Section 38. Section 38 outlines so the procedures for appealing the penalty. I guess we're on Section 39. 39 is the civil penalties. This is the language we have. It's similar to what we have in pesticide and fertilizer area. This is the new enforcement that we'd get to be able to issue civil penalties in addition to the other enforcement tools that we have. Section 40 deals with, it's similar to existing law. It makes it a criminal offense, again, to violate our law, and then it enhances that crime for violation if the violation endangers humans or animals, or if the violation was with knowledge. Those violations, there's, again, the language is subdivision 2, the one dealing with endangering humans or animals, is similar language to what we have in our pesticide and fertilizer area, and subdivision 3 is existing law. We just moved it over to here. And then Section 41 and 42 is existing law as well. We moved it over here into this section. It just outlines the abilities, outlines the department's process when we embargo or condemn a product. That's Section 41. And Section 42 is dealing with our authority, dealing with people in intrastate commerce, what we can do. And then Section 43 is the repealer. We'll be repealing all those the different statutes that have been consolidated into one. So.
Any questions from members for Mr. Spanier, Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Spanier, you say you're the attorney for the Department of Agriculture. What other areas was mentioned here? You know, we're talking about food, law enforcement, and that's in the title of the bill on the line 1.2. And you said we had taken out feed law enforcement or that situation. What other, and you mentioned pesticides, what other areas in the Department of Ag would be considered, or you could take the word food and put in another word, such as feed or pesticides, or what other areas do you have jurisdiction over as far as law enforcement within the Department of Ag?
Mr. Spanier.
Well, Mr. Chair, committee members, we got pesticide and fertilizer, we have noxious weed, we have seed, we have nursery, we have food. And I think if there's anything else. I believe that's...
Mr. Chairman, if I may, the food, of course...
Ms. Gothier, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Anderson. The food, of course, would include meat and dairy, et cetera. Yeah, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Spanier, the reason I'm asking, I'm just wondering that if, because you've already mentioned that this the law says that you can collect attorney fees if somebody breaks the law. What happens if it's the flip side, where someone brings a lawsuit against the state of Minnesota? Can they, too, collect attorney fees against the state?
Mr. Spanier.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I believe in section, or in chapter 14, under the administrative law procedures, I think there's a section in chapter 14 that says if our actions are, and I don't know the exact standard level, but if the actions that we took are, I don't know the standard, frivolous or whatever, that there are abilities for them to recoup their attorney's fees.
Okay, thank you.
And that's in the standard chapter 14 administrative section.
Thank you.
I have a question from Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, my mind about the egg issue. You know, I'm now paying a lot of money for the best eggs I can get. And I do that because of fear. And I remember not too long ago the episode where the hatchery person had filthy, awful conditions where those chickens were and where those eggs came from. And I'm wondering about the illnesses that people like myself would probably incur and what type of penalty then would be issued for that person. Is it just a cleanup, or did you shut them down, or how far did that go, and what was the resolution there?
Mr. Spanier, Mr. Wong.
Chair. Committee members, I don't know if Dave Reed has any comment on that. I believe that was handled by the FDA because it was an interstate issue, because it had involved multiple states. I don't know if you had any more.
Come on down. And please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Reed. Last name is R-E-A-D. I'm with the Dairy and Food Inspection Division at the Department of Agriculture. We do have an egg regulatory program. We do have egg laws, but most of our activity occurs at the packing and the retail level. FDA does have direct authority down at the farm level, and they have actually asked us now to enter into a contract with them to do some egg inspections on the farm to make sure that they're complying with the new salmonella enteritis rules.
Follow up, Representative.
Well, thank you. I'm paying almost $4 a dozen for eggs, and then there are cheaper eggs, and I'm afraid to buy the cheaper eggs. Can you reassure me that they are safe?
Mr. Reed, that's a good question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do have an inspection program. Safe is a word that we, have difficulty saying that everything is safe. We do have a regulatory program in place. A lot of the safety responsibility does fall upon the producer themselves to make sure they're producing a safe product. We do monitoring in the marketplace and in those industries where they're packaging and making sure that they are using sanitary conditions.
Okay, thanks. Any other questions from members? I had one. Every month or so we get kind of a green sheet, or maybe it's just farmers, I don't know, with the Department of Ag news and updates, and in that you list violations and fines for the past month. They can range from spills to misapplications to not keeping correct records. And the fines vary from a couple of $20, $30, $50 up to a couple $1,000s for some. How are those fines assessed? Could you walk us through the process for how somebody or some organization is fined, and how do you classify those fines?
Mr. Chair, committee members, in that pesticide and fertilizer area, they have set up criteria, and they've had this for years. Basically, what the violation and what the cost is, and what that is as they go through. So they've got it. It's a chart that they've got where they know in advance these certain violations are worth this much, and they put it together like that, and it's been used for years, and so they've just got a system in place. I think they put that together maybe in the 80s, and they've used that same process.
Okay. Any questions from members of the public who would care to testify on this bill? Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I see there's no Senate companion for this. I'm just wondering what the intentions are of the author or of you as the chair.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Anderson, you're right. I spoke with Senator Magnus, and they did not hear this over in the Senate. It was a bill working with the department. This is a bill that came to us late in the process. We wanted to have an informational hearing. I know there's been a tremendous amount of work that went into this bill already, over 18 months, I think. People have been working on this. But we've also been contacted, now that this has been out and the public has read it, we've been contacted by a number of folks that have concerns as well. So we wanted to take this time to have informational only hearing on this. Again, to get this out so everybody's aware of this as well. It's not going anywhere in the Senate. We're not going to be voting on it here today either. And so that's the update. That's why we're here, Representative Anderson.
Thank
Representative
you.
Anderson.
Thank you.
I had one last question going back to page 24 on line 24.6, talking about license revocations, violations within the last 3 years. Are most of those permits and licenses usually issued on an annual basis, or how often do most of these permits get issued?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I believe they're all annual basis. So July 1st to June 30th.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, just a point of clarification, perhaps, on starts on line 26 there at the bottom. It's 26.32, a violation endangering humans or animals, and it talks about the Girl Smith that goes along with that. I'm just curious as to the standards that apply in this regard for determining endangerment to humans or animals. You must have a list of things you go down and to determine that. I'm curious as to a little bit about that list.
Okay. Mr. Spanier.
Mr. Chair, committee members. Again, this would be new language. It's language we have in our pesticide and fertilizer area, but it's not over here in this area. But, yeah, there are certain violations that, you know, are tend to be, more technical violations that really aren't ones that endanger humans or animals. I'm trying to think on dairy and food area. Dave, you could think of some ones. I mean, there's some technical ones that might be a violation, but they really don't endanger humans or animals. And then there'd be the, you know, obviously ones that are a little larger with actually, you know, putting things into the food or anything like that.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Reed,
it would come to me instant. You know, my first thought on that would be if somebody deliberately contaminated or deliberately adulterated a food product. That would be an area that we'd look at certainly look at gross misdemeanor. There are certain violations, I think, that can occur that are so egregious that they might rise to a felony level that we might be able to use a different chapter for. But in essence, this would be new language for us, and we would be developing that criteria that where this would apply.
Representative Purcell.
Well, just following along that line, then, would the instance that Representative Fritz raised with regard to the eggs and that were found to not be in a very good situation where those eggs were produced, would so that individual is putting something out on the market that clearly seemed to be an endangerment. Would that raise to that level?
Mr. Reed?
Mr. Chair, potentially yes. The decision is made on the specific facts that are found in the case. And so if there was a deliberate act to do something, and especially if someone had been told not to do it and continued or proceeded to do it anyway, those would be factors that we would have to consider.
Follow up,
Mr. Chair, and I just not going to drill down too far into this, but you're leading me on here. So maybe you better not answer the next one. Well, I'm curious then, going to the example that Representative Fritz raised. If we do have someone that is producing eggs, and I don't know. I mean, I'm a humble chemist. I know when we do chemistry, we have standard operating procedures. Here's how you do it. I'm assuming, I'm also an old farm boy, so I'm assuming you do things according to some standards. So if they're violating those standards, that would be assumed, and it results in eggs that are not edible. That would rise to that level then.
Well, Mr. Chair, committee members, we have, for instance, right now, when we look at a penalty on somebody, we have a matrix that we look at, and we say these types of violations, and then there's a, based on these facts and on these factors, this is where we put it in the matrix, and we come out with a number, and this is what we look at. Again, on these types of things, on a violation of whether it harms somebody or not, we would. I mean, it's going to be fact-based, obviously, at some point. A dirt in the corner somewhere may not be, we found some dirt in the corner and that's a violation versus, some other violation. It's going to be a fact-based thing. But, yes, we could put together, when we get this language passed, there'll be a way to put together some kind of matrix system for these types of violations to say, okay, this could rise up to a level to be an enhanced crime. Also keep in mind that we wouldn't bring it. We bring the case to the county attorney or the city attorney, so in a criminal matter. So when we take it, in these cases, we would take all the facts that we have and provide it and go to the city or the county attorney that takes these cases and say, here's our evidence. We believe that this is a violation of this statute and do it. It's still up to that county attorney or city attorney to decide whether they're going to take that case or not and whether they want to do that. So there's we have had sometimes in criminal cases where we've brought it forward and the city or county attorney has said, well, no, I don't think so, or I've got to, we need to have other evidence, we need to do this. So there's another break in the decision back.
Any more questions? Very good. We haven't, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And whether we're talking about the commercial feed side or any portion of this, how will this affect interstate commerce? Will there be a negative impact at all with interstate commerce? That was one of the questions that was brought up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, they have a no. I mean, it shouldn't affect because we are not changing the definitions of anything. The inspectors that are out on the field, this shouldn't affect what they do on a daily basis. There's nothing in here. In fact, our inspectors probably don't even know about these changes because it doesn't affect what they do on a daily basis and water violations or whatever. It only comes in fact because, again, the definitions aren't changing. The only thing that we put together in 34A is sort of the enforcement mechanisms that get used once the 5 to 10% cases or whatever that end up having to go to enforcement, what happens at that point? And so it shouldn't affect interstate commerce at all.
Representative Hamilton.
And just to follow up, and maybe you'd understand this question. Again, it came in via email. They're asking about the uniform modeled feed statutes as far as across the nation. And if the feds have already dealt with this, do we have to make changes here as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Now, the model code that's out there, that is put together, and it's particularly in the feed area. Again, that's a bunch of states coming together in a meeting where they discuss it and they put together sort of a model code on items. It's just a suggestion, again, for the states to take up. That's sort of a uniformity issue. In particular, on the feed issue, again, when you get to the enforcement mechanism, the model code talks about really about, you know, the substantive things about feed. So in terms of how businesses interact on a daily basis and how they label things, how they do those things, that's in the model code, and the states have adopted that, and we've adopted most of the model code. There are some things we haven't adopted from the model code. When it comes to the enforcement mechanism, the model code may not. The model code for feed talks about it in the enforcement guidelines, but it's not in the model code. The reason being is that every state has their own enforcement mechanisms that they use for within their state. So when you're talking about model codes for the industry that they put together, they're putting together for uniformity in what they do as a business. It's not on the uniformity in how they do enforcement mechanisms. Now, and I will also say, I guess we talked about this earlier in that document that did come out on the model code. We do have, we believe that's inaccurate. We have done our own checking on civil penalties authorities in other states, and of the 25 states we've checked into so far, 14 of those states have civil penalty authority. So when they say there's two or three, that's not correct. So, and again, the model code and the people, the AFCO and some of those people who have looked into it, and Dave can say more about it, they didn't address it in the model code itself because it's the states that decide those enforcement.
Mr. Reed.
Mr. Chair, they're actually in the model bill for AFCO. They do include misdemeanor criminal authority, but that bill was developed probably prior to 1969, and that was generally the process that was done probably for most provisions. We have a lot of misdemeanor authority in our other food laws as well. Over time, that has changed. And in AFCO, it's one little provision in their model bill which covers dozens of other provisions to try to establish uniformity. AFCO, which is the Association of Feed Control Officials, which I participated in back in the 90s when I worked in the feed area, developed an enforcement guidelines group that actually developed a whole series of enforcement guidelines and looked at tools that included civil penalty, administrative penalty, and misdemeanor, and those sorts of things.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Spanier or the other testifiers, has any of these criminal penalties ever risen to the level of either the state's attorney or the U.S. attorney general? A case going to that high level? You mentioned county attorneys that you would mostly, because it sounds like most of you are dealing with the local, but have any of these things risen to a higher level than that?
Mr. Chair, committee members,
Spanier.
We work with the AG's office on any enforcement that we do. So they're involved in any of the administrative actions we take. There's three options for agencies. One is administrative option, one is criminal, one is civil penalties. The administrative actions always, we go through the Attorney General's office. They're the people that go to court and do that. Criminal, we take it to the city or county attorney. We've done that on misdemeanor issues, we've done that a couple times. We don't normally like to have to do that, but normally what we do is we try to do it, administrative penalty. We first try to get them into compliance just to get them there. If they don't want to do that, then we have to start looking at penalties to try to persuade them to get to that level. And sometimes if that doesn't work, and trying to persuade them and the administrative penalties hasn't worked and they still don't want to do anything, at that point the only thing left to do is to take them criminally. And at that, then we do that, and it goes to the city attorney or county attorney. And most of our violations are all misdemeanors in the statute, except for the, we do have the knowingly violate right now, which would be a gross misdemeanor. And I don't know if we've ever taken that in the last couple of years. I don't know of anywhere we haven't done that. There is a felony food adulteration in the statute. It's not here. It's in the criminal procedures, criminal statutes, and I don't I've never been aware of anybody who've gone that route. So,
thank you. Does this bill do anything to increase penalties or raise fines on people? Does it address the amounts of fines or penalties?
Mr. Chair, committee members, it doesn't. I believe the amounts that we put in are the same amounts as before. So that hasn't changed the amounts or anything like that. The civil penalty authority would be new, so we would be able to issue civil penalties. And that's something that this division hasn't had. It would be in other divisions have had that.
Okay. Any other questions from members or anybody from the public? Anybody want to testify either for or against the bill? Seeing none, that closes the public portion of our testimony. We haven't approved the minutes yet. Representative Kath, would you approve the minutes from our last meeting?
So moved.
Thank you very much. Minutes are approved from last meeting. This is an informational hearing. On the minutes. All in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. I was just going to take your word for it, Representative. Minutes are approved. And this was informational in scope today, so with that, today's... Oh, Representative Hamilton.
Okay. Okay. We're just talking here. We are going to have a few informational hearings coming up. I know we talked early on in session with members and a few items, informational only. I want to stress that. Would be the raw milk piece and also the stray voltage piece. The wineries contacted us again. I know they're on the schedule earlier this year. They could not make it, and so they asked if we could reschedule because they wanted to be able to come in. So they weren't able to get on our agenda early on in the legislative process. So they did contact us once again, and they'd like to come before our committee. And then I was visiting with Representative Poppy, and she had a great idea about some rural economic development type things as well. So just be watching for that, members. And
Representative Anderson.
Well, just before I came here to committee, I was told that we are having session next Wednesday from 9 to 12, and that's the same time that the Ag Committee would be meeting. And so I'm just wondering what your intentions are.
Representative Hamilton.
We're going to overrule session. We'll plan. Yeah, that's right. We'll plan accordingly. We'll plan accordingly, and we'll let you know.
Hey, any other questions, comments? If not, the meeting is adjourned.